From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Stax Records in Memphis helped define the Southern soul sound of the 60s with hits by Otis Redding, Wilson Pickett, Booker T and the MGs, Sam and Dave, and Isaac Hayes. The Stax Museum of American Soul Music opened earlier this month, and new Stax reissues have been released. On today's Fresh Air, Stax house guitarist Steve Cropper tells us about helping Otis Redding write Dock of the Bay, and Isaac Hayes tells us about writing Soul Man. Several Stax artists, along with other soul singers, are profiled in the new documentary Only the Strong Survive, named after Jerry Butler's hit record. Butler will tell us the story behind the song. Soul music, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush observed the Memorial Day holiday by laying the traditional wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns. The president made special mention of those who died in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as the hundreds of thousands who died in the nation's world wars, Vietnam and Korea. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld also spoke at Arlington National Cemetery, saying Americans have a duty to remember those who lost their lives in the service of their country.
We come each year to this place to celebrate their memory and to honor their sacrifice. It's appropriate that we do so, for only by remembering how great their sacrifice can we fully appreciate the value they placed on freedom.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. The U.S. Administrator in Iraq, Paul Bremer, said today that U.S. forces have done much to restore stability to the country, including restoring electricity and water in some places and putting more police on the streets. Bremer, who's been in Baghdad for 2 weeks, said the U.S. will help Iraq use its oil wealth to rebuild its economy.
There is still a lot to do, there's no doubt. But with the new Security Council resolution passed on Friday, we've brought Iraq back out of the darkness of international isolation and back into the fold of responsible, outward-looking countries.
Bremer, a former anti-terrorism official at the State Department, said free markets will help in Iraq's transition to democracy.
A free economy and a free people go hand in hand.
Bremer said he'll keep working to make sure that former Ba'ath Party members are excluded from the Iraqi government. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon was attacked by members of his own Likud party today over the cabinet's approval of the U.S.-backed roadmap to peace. Sharon told his critics that Israel's occupation of the Palestinians cannot continue indefinitely. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Nearly all of the 40 Likud members of the Knesset had harsh words for their prime minister. The sharpest criticism came from former Foreign Minister David Levy, who said the roadmap contained the worst things ever faced by the government of Israel. Another Knesset member said it was a roadmap to hell and that Israel had surrendered to Palestinian terrorism. Others were angry that there was no internal debate in the Likud before Sharon brought it to a cabinet vote where it passed 12-7 with 4 abstentions. Sharon hit back at his critics, saying it is not possible for Israel to continue holding 3.5 million people under occupation. He said this is terrible for Israel, for the Palestinians, and for the Israeli economy. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Palestinian officials say Sharon will meet with Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas on Wednesday. This is NPR News. A U.S. doctor suspected of developing symptoms of SARS is reported in good condition. He was returned to the United States from Taiwan, where he was investigating the disease. NPR's Joseph Shapiro reports.
The doctor was advising hospital officials in Taiwan about how to stop the spread of SARS. He's an expert on infection control for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Now he's back in the United States, and a spokeswoman for the CDC reports he is in isolation and in good condition. The CDC flew him back to Atlanta on an air ambulance this weekend after he developed a fever and cough. Georgia's state health officials have listed him as a suspected SARS case, but it may turn out that he has a different respiratory illness. 3 other CDC workers were flown back as well. All 3 had contact with the man, and they too are under isolation. But none of them has shown symptoms of SARS. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. troops were killed and injured yesterday and today in at least three incidents in Iraq. U.S. military officials say three soldiers were hurt in Baghdad today when an explosion destroyed their Humvee. They said the cause of the blast wasn't clear. U.S. officials also say one American soldier was killed and another was wounded today during an ambush in northern Iraq. The soldiers were reported to be in a convoy that was fired upon by unknown attackers using automatic weapons and rocket-propelled grenades. The troops were members of the 3rd Armored Cavalry. Earlier, officials say a U.S. soldier was killed and another injured in an explosion at a munitions dump they were guarding. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, seeking to improve people's lives by supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and child abuse prevention.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Stax Records produced some of the greatest Southern soul music of the 60s. Music by such performers as Otis Redding, Wilson Pickett, Rufus and Carla Thomas, Booker T and the MGs, Isaac Hayes, and the Staple Singers. The Stax Museum of American Soul Music just opened in Memphis on the site of the label's former studios. And new Stax reissues have been released. Here's some examples of the Stax sound. Steve Cropper was the house guitarist at Stax Records. The house band recorded their own records under the name Booker T and the MGs. Cropper also worked as a songwriter and producer for Stax. He produced some of Otis Redding's hits.
I've been loving you too long to stop now. Be free. I don't want to stop now. Oh. With you, my life has been so wonderful.
When I spoke with Steve Cropper in 1990, he told me he thought his strength as a guitarist was rhythm.
I never really was a lead player. I never tried to be a lead player. I've been lucky enough to have played a few solos on some great artist records. But really, I'm a rhythm man, and my best forte, I think, is capturing the feel of a song during its inception in the studio. I think that's where I'm best. Even though people fly me in all over to play on their records and overdub, I think they would be better using me on the ground floor, you know, as a building block rather than as a cherry on the cake.
That's interesting, and also that they'd be able to work off of your rhythm while they were
Yeah,
performing.
They don't think of it in those terms because I don't either they don't know me, they just know the aftermath of some of the things I've been lucky enough to be part of. But I don't know what if it's a gift or it's because I had such a love for, like I said, spiritual music in the beginning, that I have this talent that just sort of comes with finding the right groove for a song when I'm in the studio with an artist. And that seems to be the thing that always seems to make it, whether we're working with Rod Stewart. You know, I did a lot of stuff with Rod and Tommy Dowd, and I did a lot of the original stuff with Ringo and stuff, you know, when he did his solo albums and all. And those were the songs that seemed to make it up the charts, the ones that I was there on the ground for, helping the rhythm with the drummer and stuff like that.
You had your first hit with a band called The Marquees.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me about who the band was and how you made the record.
Well, originally, Charlie Freeman and I, we started playing guitar with each other, and we just sort of had fun, and he was taking lessons, and he'd go to his lesson, and I'd wait for him at his house for him to get back, and he'd teach me what he learned that day. So I was kind of cheating the system a little bit. But anyway, we just started playing different things. We did some Elvis songs and some rock and roll and stuff like that. And we had a friend who thought that we were good. Obviously, we probably were pretty lousy at the time, but we didn't know that. And he said, I've got a friend who's a disc jockey. He said, I'd like to take you guys down there and let him hear you, you know, and we're just young guys. So anyway, he took us down to his radio show one night. The guy's name was Keith Sheriff. And we went down there, and he said, okay, what do you guys got? You know, we told him we've got some songs and so forth. He said, well, I want to hear you. And so he put us in a studio, the two of us, and opened up a mic. He said, now, you know, I'm doing my show now, but he said, I can hear you guys. And he said, you just go ahead and do your thing, you know. So we started playing our stuff, you know, played a couple of songs, and he motioned for us to come in. And about that time, the phone started lighting up, and they were wanting to know, who are those two guys that they just heard? And I'm going, what's this? And he said, well, I didn't tell y'all, but he said, I put you out on the air. So anyway, all these people were calling, wanting to know who we were. And so he told us, he was pretty famous for his sock hops, and he'd have these sock hops every Saturday night at the National Guard Army. And he said, if you guys get a drummer, he said, I'll put you on my sock hop. And so we searched the school and found a guy in the ninth grade who played drums, Terry Johnson. And that was the first band, and we were called the Royal Spades. And shortly after that, we added Duck Dunn on bass, and we got Charlie Axton on saxophone, and Wayne Jackson on trumpet, and Don Nix on baritone, and formed the group The Marquees. And we had written this song with Jerry Lee Smoochie Smith on keyboards and wrote the instrumental last night. And I think they played it for Atlantic. Atlantic liked it. They pressed up a few copies and put it out on the radio, and lo and behold, it just took off like crazy. So that was our first success.
How old were you when you and the group The Marquees had the hit last night?
When the hit came out, I just graduated. It was the summer we graduated from high school. So I was, 19, 18?
Now, it wasn't long after that that you became affiliated with Stax Records. You became the guitarist in the house rhythm section, you became a producer, you became a songwriter with
Floor with Sweeper.
Stax. Yeah, right.
Tape copier and editor.
How did you get affiliated with Stax?
Well, it started Charles Axton, the tenor player, and the funny story about Charles Axton.
He was the tenor player with the Marquees?
He was a tenor player with the Marquees. He was on the record last night and everything. he came to me and he said, I hear you guys got a pretty good band. He said, you know, I play saxophone. I'd like to be in your band. And I said, well, I'm not really interested. I don't think we're interested in adding horns to the group. And I said, how long have you been playing, you know? And he said, oh, I've been taking lessons for 3 months. And I'm going, oh, yeah, great, you know. And somewhere in the conversation, he goes, oh, by the way, my mother owns a recording studio. And I said, can you show up for rehearsal on Saturday? And that is a true story now. I may stretch it a little bit, but that's an actual truth. And we went out. His uncle, Jim Stewart, the owner of Stax Records, had a little studio in his garage in Memphis, and we went out there and jammed around, and then they moved from his garage to a little place out in Brunswick, Tennessee, where they had the Satellite label. And we would go out there every weekend and play and all that. And of course, Jim Stewart said we never had a chance, we'd never make it. But I think he just was being devil's advocate to just see if he could push us into something. And we kept trying. We cut a bunch of instrumentals, some crazy little things that never saw the light of day. And until the time that we came up with Last Night. But what happened was Estelle Axton, I don't know if she saw any talent there or what she saw, but she liked me enough to keep me around, and she put me to work in her record shop. And I sold records. That's what I did. And I kept working on the weekends. I would kind of do a little A&Ring because people were always coming in. And on Saturdays, I would hold auditions because people were always bringing in songs and all that. And that's sort of how I got started, you know, in the A&R thing. And finally, Jim said, wait a minute. He said, you know, Steve's spending more time in the studio and he is in the record shop and whatever. And so they got together and decided that I would be start getting my salary from the record company rather than the record shop. And I started working, I guess, A&R full time at that point.
Well, you, with the group Booker T and the MGs, had the hit of Green Onions, and I think this was it's a big hit, and it helped out Stax Records a lot. How did the four of you, Booker T, Al Jackson, Donald Duck Dunn, and yourself get to play together and become the house rhythm section?
Well, what it all stemmed from basically was there we were with all this great success doing the Dick Clark Show and everything as the Marquees, and we had this big hit record Last Night, and it was a lot of fun. And then all of a sudden it wasn't fun anymore. It became work and what you call a road burdened and that sort of thing, and seven of us or eight of us traveling in one car and trying to make all these shows. And I found out that I wasn't too happy with the road. And so what I really wanted to do was get back in the studio. I mean, I'd already knew that that's what I wanted to do. Anyway, that's what I did. I came back to Memphis. I went to work in the studio again. I helped put together the rhythm section. I found out I'd been playing with another band called the Club Handy Band, and we had done some sessions for Don Roby. I don't even remember which songs, but I played on the Five Blind Boys albums. I played on Al T&T Braggs. I think there was some Bobby Blue Bland stuff that I played on. But I played with a lot of those musicians, and we were asking around to find out who was a real good keyboard player. We had used several, and they said, there's this kid, he's still in school, named Booker T. Jones, and he's incredible. And they had worked with him on a lot of other stuff and on stage as well. And so we got Booker over on a session, and everybody just fell in love with him.
Let me play some of Green Onions, and because we're only going to play an excerpt, I'm going to start this a little in because I want to get to your guitar solo in it. So this is Green Onions, Booker T and the MGs. We'll hear more of our interview with Steve Cropper after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1990 interview with Steve Cropper. He worked as a songwriter, producer, and house guitarist for the Memphis soul label Stax Records. The Stax Museum of American Soul Music just opened on the site of the label's studio. I want to ask you about some of the now classic records that you played on. Some of these are songs that you co-wrote. You co-wrote Dock of the Bay with Otis Redding, and you produced the record as well, right?
Right, correct.
What was your collaboration with him like when it came to writing songs?
Well, of course, we wrote a lot of songs together. The inception of Dock of the Bay was really no different than any other one. Otis was one of those kind of guys who had 100 ideas, and he always had with him, anytime he came in to record, 10 or 15 different pretty good ideas, either intros or titles or whatever. And he had been in San Francisco doing the Fillmore. And the story that I got, he had rented a boathouse or stayed out at a boathouse or something. And that's when he got the idea of watching the ships come in the bay there. And that's about all he had. I watched the ships come in, watch them roll away again, and I'm sitting on the dock of the bay. And I just took that. We just sat down, and I just kind of learned the changes that he was kind of running over. And I finished the lyrics. And if you listen to songs that I collaborated with Otis, most of the lyrics are about him. Well, he never really, he might say the big O in a song or something like that, but Otis didn't really write about himself, but I did. Songs like Mr. Pitiful, Sad Song, Fa Fa, they were all about Otis and Otis's life, and Dock of the Bay is exactly that. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. It was all about him going out to San Francisco to perform. And that's kind of the way I wrote with Otis. I wrote the bridge and stuff like that. And that's the way we collaborated. He trusted me. I always seemed to do the things that he liked. Worked on songs that came out the way he wanted them. And I also worked on a lot of songs with Otis, arrangement-wise, and helped him put them together and all that, where I didn't, claim any writers or anything, because it wasn't necessary. Otis had most of it finished to begin with. And I just helped him do it. But a lot of these things where he had just bits and pieces, I would actually put them together, and we'd make whole songs out of them and go in the next day and record them. So we had a lot of fun together. Otis was a great guy to work with, and he was a great friend.
Well, let's listen to the record. This is Dock of the Bay.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, and then I'll watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm just sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay, 'cause I've had nothing to live for, and look like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm sitting on a dock of the bay, wasting time. Look like nothing's gonna change, everything still remains the same. I can't do what 10 people tell me to do, so I guess I'll remain the same. Listen, sitting here resting my bones, and this loneliness won't leave me alone. Listen, 2,000 miles I roam, just to make this dock my home. Now I'm just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on a dock of the bay, wasting time.
Dock of the Bay, recorded by Otis Redding in 1967. Redding co-wrote the song with Steve Cropper. Cropper told me it was his idea to mix in the sound of the waves.
Atlantic said they were a little too loud, but I stuck in there. I kept them in. I thought the birds in the ocean was great.
I want to ask you about another record. And this is also a song you co-wrote. You co-wrote this one with Wilson Pickett, and it's Midnight Hour.
Uh-huh.
This was, I think, for the first session that you played with Wilson Pickett.
Right, it was.
Tell me about writing the song with him.
Well, it's real simple. We knew that he was coming down, and, of course, my connection with the record shop. And I went up and found some stuff that he had sung on. Of course, he sang, you know, with the Falcons, and he had sang some spiritual things. And it seemed like every time that he sang lead on something, when he got down to the fade-out, he would go, oh, wait till the midnight hour. Whoa, see my Jesus in the midnight hour. And all this, I said, that's the guy's ID. So I just took that right there, and I presented it to him with a little idea. He had a couple ideas, and what happened was that we picked him up at the airport. They dropped us off at the hotel, and Jerry Wexler and Jim Stewart went out to get something to eat and just talk business. And when they came back, I don't know, it was a couple hours later, we had In the Midnight Hour written and Don't Fight It. They said, we're going to get out of here, let you guys keep going. And they left, and we wrote a thing called I'm Not Tired. And we went in the studio the next day, recorded all three songs, and all three songs were hits.
Steve Cropper recorded in 1990. The Stax Museum of American Soul Music just opened on the site of the Stax Records Studios. More soul music in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Wilson Pickett.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the Internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more about Stax Records from songwriter, producer, and singer Isaac Hayes. And we hear from Jerry Butler, one of the soul singers profiled in the new film Only the Strong Survive, which is named after one of Butler's hits. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Memphis-based music label Stax Records released some great Southern soul music in the 60s and 70s. Now the site of the label's studios is the home of the new Stax Museum of American Soul Music. Isaac Hayes recorded several hit albums for Stax, including Hot Buttered Soul, Black Moses, and Shaft. He was also an important behind-the-scenes figure at Stax, working as a producer, songwriter, and arranger. He co-wrote hits for Sam and Dave, Carla Thomas, and Johnny Taylor. Now Isaac Hayes is also well known for his role in South Park as Chef. In 1994, I spoke with Hayes about his work at Stax.
Now, I know before you started making your own records, before you started singing in your records, you produced for other people, and also you played piano and keyboards. Mm-hmm. You used to play with Booker T and the MGs. Now, how did you learn to play piano? Growing up as poor as you did, I know there were times in your life when you didn't have shoes, let alone a piano.
That's true. How did I do that? Well, let's see. A friend of mine I grew up with, Sidney Kirk, used to be my accompanist. We went places and he'd play for me. He joined the Air Force. He wasn't there. There was a call into him about a gig New Year's Eve. His sister knew that I was destitute and I needed money, so she asked me if I wanted to play. Well, I could play maybe chopsticks and stuff like that. And I said, yeah, I'll take it. I took the gig out of desperation. And when I got to the club, I was petrified. I said, oh, my God, they're going to shoot me. I can't play. And musicians started coming in, you know, setting up, tuning up, and I'm sitting there, you know, trying to be cool. I said, God, they're going to find me out. And the featured artist came in and said, hey, man, do y'all know such and such? This is the first time this band had been put together. We didn't rehearse anything. And everybody said, yeah, we know it, blah, blah, blah. So he kicked off the tune, and it sounded horrible. Everybody did. I said, wow, these guys can't play either, so I'm comfortable. And, you know, being New Year's Eve, the clientele was drunk, and they thought we were cooking, you know. So, and somewhere along the line, the club owner, he was sauced. He came up and said, you know, you boys sound real good. Y'all want a regular job? Yeah, we're taking it. And that was in Memphis. And it was a regular gig. And each night I would learn something more and more on keyboards. And that's how I got started.
That's great. And then you started sitting in with Booker T and the MGs.
Well, I wound up at Stax Records. I changed bands, and I joined Floyd Newman's band, who was a staff musician at Stax. He played baritone saxophone. All those bot-ups and stuff like that, that was Floyd. So he was up for recording. He said, man, you know, we're going in the studio. And I had been, prior, I had been to Stax about three different times with the blues band, with a vocal group, you know, trying to get a break, and it was always turned down.
Mm-hmm.
This time went in with Floyd and Howard Grimes, a drummer. He and I wrote some songs, some instrumentals and things like that. And Jim Stewart, who, you know, was on a co-owner of Stax, he said, you know, you sound pretty good on keyboards. Booker T is off in Indiana U in school. Would you like to become a staff musician here? Yeah, you know. So that's how I got in Stax. And my first session, I think, was an Otis Redding album session. I was scared to death. But he made it easy. And I learned a lot, and I fit right in. And I became a staff musician. So when Booker came back, he and I both played on sessions. We'd switch around. Sometimes I'd play organ, and he'd play piano. And sometimes I'd play piano, he'd play organ. And with Duck, Steve, and Al, we were the nucleus of Stax, the rhythm section, and then, of course, the horns and so forth.
Now, you were not only a house musician at Stax, you became a house songwriter, and you wrote a lot of songs with your partner then, David Porter. And some of the most famous songs that you wrote were for Sam and Dave, like Soul Man and Hold On, I'm Coming. How were you given them to write for?
Well, first thing, David, when I started at Stax on staff, David and I went to rival schools, sang in rival groups. And he said, hey, man, I write lyrics and you play music. Let's hook up and write like Holland Doja Holland. I said, okay. So we teamed up and we started writing. And one day, Jim Stewart called us all, everybody on staff, said, we got some fellas coming down, and they need some writers and producers. So they're going to come around and meet with everybody, and you show them what you got. So when Sam and Dave and them came to town, they, you know, met with everybody, and they wanted to work with David and me. And that's how the whole thing started.
What do you remember about writing Soul Man?
Well, I remember getting the idea from watching TV and the riots in Detroit. And it was said that if you put soul on your door, your business establishment, they would bypass it and wouldn't burn it. And then the word soul, you know, the clenched fist, you know, soul brother, soul this. It was a galvanizing kind of thing as far as, you know, African Americans were concerned. And it had that kind of effect of unity, and they said it with a lot of pride. So I said, well, why not write a tune called Soul Man? And all you had to do was write about your own personal experiences, because, you know, everybody, all African Americans in this country, during those times especially, had similar experiences. So we did that, but realized that in addition to being an African American experience, it was a human experience. So therefore, it crossed the board, and then the groove and all everything else that went with it.
Isaac Hayes, recorded in 1994. Here's Soul Man, arranged and co-written by Isaac Hayes. Coming up, Only the Strong Survive. We hear from soul singer Jerry Butler. This is Fresh Air. The new documentary, Only the Strong Survive, profiles singers who helped define the soul sound of the 60s and 70s, including several Stax artists like Wilson Pickett, Carla Thomas, and Isaac Hayes. The movie is named after a hit song by Jerry Butler, another singer profiled in the film. We're going to hear an interview I recorded with Butler in 2000. In 1957, Jerry Butler teamed up with Curtis Mayfield to form the vocal group The Impressions. The group's first hit was the 1958 record For Your Precious Love, featuring Butler singing lead. The following year, Butler left the group to start a solo career, going on to have such hits as He Will Break Your Heart, Moon River, Make It Easy on Yourself, Western Union Man, and Only the Strong Survive. Butler was born in rural Mississippi in 1939. 3 years later, he moved with his family to Chicago, where he still lives. In fact, he's now in politics, serving his fifth term on the Cook County Board of Commissioners. Let's start with some music.
I remember my first love affair. Somehow or another, the whole darn thing went wrong. But my mama had some great advice, so I thought I'd put it in the words of this song. I can still hear her saying, boy,
boy, boy.
Oh, I see you sitting out there all alone, crying your eyes out, 'cause the woman that you love is gone. Oh, there's gonna be a whole lot of trouble in your life. So listen to me, get up off your knees, 'cause only the strong survive. That's what she said, she's only the strong survive. Only the strong survive. Yeah, you gotta be strong. You better hold on.
Jerry Butler, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Tell us the story behind this song.
Actually, this song and the lyrics were actual conversation that I had with my mother when I was about 16 years old. I was in love with an older woman, if you can believe that. And naturally, she said, this is a kid. I've got to move on with my life and do some other things. And so she just kind of dropped me like a hot potato. So I went, told Mama, hey, look, this is the end of the world. She said, boy, let me tell you this, that you have not seen half of the beautiful, lovely women in this world. And for you to be going through these kinds of changes this early in your life is absolutely ridiculous. Get out of here. You'll get over it. And Only the Strong Survive was really created out of that conversation. Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff were the co-writers on it, but the introduction that was recited was really from that conversation with my mother.
Now, you first sang gospel music. You were part of a group called the Northern Jubilee Singers, and Curtis Mayfield was in that group, too. And, of course, you also sang together in The Impressions. How did you first meet?
Curtis's grandmother, the Reverend Annabelle Mayfield, was the pastor of this little congregation called the Traveling Soul Spiritualist Church. And Curtis's older cousins had this little group called the Northern Jubilee Singers. I wound up at this church one afternoon with a friend of mine, a fellow by the name of Terry Williams, because we just had singing in common and loved to do it. And he said, I want you to meet these people and get to know them, and maybe you'll decide to get involved with the group. In fact, I did. We used to kick Curtis to the side because he was probably 9 years old. He was the little guy. You know, I was 13. I was an old man. And so we kind of kept shoving him to the back, until he learned how to play the guitar. And then he kind of just took over because he was the real musician out of the group.
Had your voice changed yet?
As a matter of fact, it had. My voice went into the baritone register when I was about 13, and it has never come up again.
What about Curtis Mayfield's? His couldn't have. He was only 9. How did he sound?
Well, you know, Curtis was just the opposite. Curtis always kind of sounded like a little girl, you know. You gotta keep on pushing. Can't stop now. Move up a little higher. So he always had that kind of thing going. And I think over time, he effectively, as Smokey has done, used it to the point that it became really kind of his natural sound.
Now, did you and Curtis Mayfield leave gospel music for rhythm and blues at about the same time?
You know, see, we were never big and famous as was Sam Cooke or Lou Rawls with the Pilgrim Travelers and Sam Cooke with the Soul Stirrers. We were basically a local group of kids attached to this one particular church. And even though on occasion we might wind up in the company of those great stars, we were never really known outside of the city of Chicago. And so when we started singing rhythm and blues, nobody was really affected by it, but maybe the people who belonged to the church and us. When Sam left, that was an uproar throughout the whole country in most of the churches, because here was this gospel icon that had gone from singing the sacred music to singing the secular music. And so there was a lot of, gnashing of teeth and carrying on about that. But Curtis and I, we really made the, and I would like to say we made an extension rather than a transition. Because even in Curtis's music, throughout the civil rights movement or what have you, you can still hear the strains of the gospel. And he really wrote kind of inspirational songs as opposed to what I call Hope to Die love songs, which are the kind of things that I was writing.
What's an example of a Hope to Die love song?
Your precious love means more to me than any love could ever be. Whereas he was writing, gotta keep on pushing, can't stop now, move up a little higher, you see?
Yeah, yeah.
A difference in attitude.
Well, I think it's time to hear your first hit. For Your Precious Love, which was recorded in 1958 when you were with The Impressions. And you say that this was, that the lyric was originally a poem that you wrote when you were in high school?
Yes, a poem called They Say, as a matter of fact. as you will hear it in the lyric.
Was it changed at all for the lyric, or is it exactly the same?
The only thing that was changed is the title, For Your Precious Love.
Okay, this is 1958, Jerry Butler and the Impressions. Now, you recorded For Your Precious Love in your first recording session for VJ, and you also recorded that day Sweet Was the Wine, which was supposed to be the A-side.
Actually, we thought, when I say we, I thought, and most of the people who were in the room when For Your Precious Love was recorded felt that For Your Precious Love was a hit. But because it was such a ballad and so slow, and so spiritual in feeling, the record company wanted to go with the other side, which was more up-tempo and danceable and supposedly more what teenagers were all about. But For Your Precious Love won out, and it was just one of those songs that teenagers as well as older people enjoyed, and it became the A-side.
Were there any squabbles about who would get to sing lead on your first recordings?
You know, it kind of came with the song. For instance, if Curtis wrote the song, Curtis sang the lead. If I wrote the song, I sang the lead. There was a squabble after For Your Precious Love was released because Vivian Carter, who owned VJ Records and was the V in VJ Records, I should say, was also a disc jockey in Gary, Indiana, and she decided, having had an experience with a group called the Spaniels, where she wanted to take the lead singer and give him a career of his own, but he was so interwoven with the fabric of the Spaniels that she was afraid she would destroy the whole thing, made a promise to herself that the next time someone came through that door that had a unique sound and had a unique voice in it, that she was going to build that unique voice along with the group. So that in later years, if there was a breakup or if she decided to move one of the parts toward another career, she could take one act and make two. The Impressions happened to be that act, and Jerry Butler happened to be that voice. And so when the recording was released, it was released as Jerry Butler and the Impressions, and the group never recovered from it. We argued and fought about the billing from that day until the day I left, which was about 7 months, 8 months later.
Did that have to do with your leaving?
Yes.
Explain more about that.
Well, here we were, five young guys, walked into a recording studio as the Impressions, walked out as Jerry Butler and the Impressions. The other four guys were wondering, well, what did Jerry do to get top billing? How did all of a sudden it start to look as though we're working for him as opposed to him being just part of the group? When we got to the Apollo Theater in New York, they have Jerry Butler in great big letters, the Impressions in small letters. By the time we get to Miami, Florida, there's just Jerry Butler on the marquee, no Impressions at all. And in each one of those places, the other guys refused to perform because their feelings were hurt, their pride was hurt. They just never could understand it. And no matter how much I told them that I hadn't done anything, that this was a decision that had been made by the record company, they just never bought it.
My guest is Jerry Butler. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Let's get back to our interview with Jerry Butler. He's one of the soul singers profiled in the new documentary, Only the Strong Survive. Did you realize yourself at the time how talented a singer and songwriter Curtis Mayfield was?
No. You know, Curtis was, when we first started, writing fairy tales. You know, Minstrel and Queen, Gypsy Woman, those kinds of little songs. And they were cute, but they, to me, did not show any out-of-sight kind of talent. About 1963, two or three, somewhere in there, he started to write the songs that, to me, were really Curtis Mayfield. He had matured to the point where he was writing We're Winner, Keep On Pushing, Say It's All Right, I'm So Proud of You. And then in the late 60s, he starts to do movie scores. Superfly, mm-hmm. and Let's Do It Again, and Claudine. And that was when, you know, my head started spinning around and I said, you know, this guy who I've treated as a younger brother most of his life and as a kid brother that, is really a genius.
You wanted him to work as your backup guitarist when you went solo.
Yeah, actually, what happened was when the group broke up, I got my share of whatever was left and started out on a solo career. I was performing in Washington, D.C., and my guitarist, who denies to this day that he did it, a fine guitarist by the name of Philip Upchurch, just quit. And he said, I'm leaving, I got a better gig, and I'm out of here. I was in a lurch. I didn't know what to do. I needed a musician to help me get through these performances. And so I called on my friend Curtis, and he responded. He said, you know, all I can play are the songs that I've written or the songs that we wrote together, and yeah, I'll do that. And so he flew out to Washington, and we started to work together. And out of that, we developed some songwriting skills between the two of us, and we started a publishing company called Curtom Music, which he later sold to Warner Brothers Music for a whole lot of money.
Now, you say in your memoir that when you were a, quote, lightweight celebrity, before you became very famous, that you still lived in the housing projects in Cabrini Green in Chicago.
Yes.
And you say you used to be able to ignore the pee in the elevators and the stairs, the wine bottles and junkies. You'd been surrounded by that kind of filth most of your life. But then it became too much to bear. What changed that made that filth too much to bear?
You know, you become oftentimes a product of your environment. Once you have something else to compare it to, then it's difficult. You know, it's like, how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris?
Mm-hmm.
You know, suddenly we were moving around. We were being treated as celebrities. We were eating in restaurants. We were going and living in hotels where the rooms were spick and span and the beds were made up perfectly and there was no smell of urine around. And suddenly we realized that it was within our reach to get out, to be part of a bigger and better world. And what I am hoping that the book will do. And as I go around talking to a lot of young people who are still living in those kinds of conditions, that you can get out. You have to work. You have to compete. But you can get out.
Jerry Butler, recorded in 2000. He's one of the soul singers profiled in the new documentary, Only the Strong Survive. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Shurrock with Ian Chillog. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Ann Peebles from the soundtrack of Only the Strong Survive.
Lying around home alone on a rainy night like this. Starving for your love. Hunger for just one kiss. Every raindrop I hear against my window pane. Beats so loud and clear. Words that spells your name still.
foolish, y'all. 'Cause after all, I didn't make myself. Tonight I cried so hard, I believe I caught the chill. Yeah. Can't control the vibration. My heart just won't stand still. No, it won't. I got nowhere to turn. Tired of being alone. Feel like breaking up somebody's home. Nowhere to turn. Tired of being alone. Feel like waking up somebody's home. Yes, I do.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Toms of Maine, maker of natural care products and creator of the Rivers Awareness Program to preserve the nation's waterways. Information at participating stores or tomsofmaine.com. And Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of A Cup of Light, a novel of art set in modern-day China by Nicole Mones. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Someday, sweetheart.
This month began with the centennial of Bing Crosby's birth. It ends with Bob Hope's 100th birthday. They star together in a series of road movies. On the next Fresh Air, jazz critic Gary Giddens talks about how Bing Crosby changed singing and American popular culture. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
You've broken, and the things that you did to me that made us drift apart.